Hello and welcome to Register, the podcast about architecture and landscape from the Kingston School of Art in London. My name is Andrew Clancy. In this episode, we are joined by the Belgian architect Jo Tellieu. Jo is an educator and a practitioner. He's professor of architecture in the EPFL Lausanne, and he directs his own practice, Jo Tellieu Architecten, based in Ghent, which he has done since about 2004. Between 2009 and 2019, he was in partnership with Jan de Wilder and Inge Vink. Throughout this time, both in collaboration and in sole practice, Jo has pursued a singular line of inquiry. He seems to come at practice and site with a curiosity and an openness, such that everyday things can be reused in new ways, where tectonic questions might be resolved in unexpected manners, and where playfulness and the expression of that playfulness becomes manifest in the built work. In this way, the assembly, its conceptual assembly and its physical assembly, is a source for the generation of a language of architecture in Jo's hands. And we discuss quite widely here both his own upbringing and what led him to architecture, and his observations about the nature of practice today, including his doubt about whether his particular type of close reading of making in particular will be possible in the nature of architectural practice in the years to come. I hope you enjoy the conversation, and I'll join you at the end. Thanks so much. Jo Tellieu, it's really lovely to have you here in Kingston. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you too for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. So I'm looking forward to the lecture.
Yeah, me too. And we generally start like at the obvious places, which is how did you decide to study architecture? At what point did it occur to you?
That's a good question. For me, my father was a carpenter, so I spent my youth in the wood shop with the leftover pieces working. And for me, that was somehow, I guess, probably a first step into architecture without knowing it.
What kind of a carpentry? Was it the site carpentry or was it more fine work?
It was more fine work. My father was, on one hand, teaching, on the other hand, also has his own carpentry work, small, very small, at home, a small atelier. He made furniture, even was designing furniture. And before he started to teach, he was working in in a company, in fact in Belgium, one of the most important, where they chairs, for example, for Bertoia.
Yeah.
They were really producing that for Europe.
Wow.
So I cannot imagine that the starting point for architecture was not born over there.
Yeah.
You see?
That's amazing, because like so often people on the podcast, when I ask them, architecture was something that their parents tried to discourage them from or they weren't so sure about. But I imagine maybe in your case, your father understood the subject or understood why you might be interested in it, or your parents generally did, or...
I have the luck to just lost my father before
so
I studied architecture. So in that sense, it was not a stimulation, but I think all the stimulation work was done before. And that was... That was so, so nice. But I understand my youngest son now is thinking about studying architecture, and I don't know if I wanted that he does that for himself. But I let him completely free in the idea about that. So it's up to him.
Yeah, it's totally natural, because when you're in a subject like this, like architecture or something creative, you become very aware of the pain of it or the difficulties of it and the chance of it, you know, that it's not easy always.
Exactly, and I really believe we are also in a transition. The architecture, how we produce architecture today, will be not the way it will be produced within 20, 30 years, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Especially my practice is really almost hands-on, from the design table to the one-to-one scale building on the construction site. I'm really very much into the production as well.
In that you think an awful lot of those tasks will be done through automated means or by other techniques?
I think it will be more globalized somehow, and the precision and the relation between the craftsman and the architect, there will be a bigger gap, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And with this bigger gap, you probably lose also the tension in the making. On the other hand, I don't think it's a negative thing. Other opportunities always appear.
Yeah.
So I found it as a kind of always a dub story. It's just like in a construction, when something went wrong, there is an opportunity to do something else. And I also believe in there are some positive things in transition towards architecture.
Always. I mean, I always get intrigued by fatalism or, you know, these kinds of things in our subject, which are very common parts of the conversation. And it's probably a temperament thing, but I kind of agree with you in that, yes, of course it changes. Like, naturally things change. And but there's still ways to find meaning in the subject even as it changes itself.
Completely agree. I think in that's maybe part of our profession or one of the skills of our profession, that we are able always to shift, to redirect, and that's then the benefit of the architect and the architect's training even.
Yeah, there's a great quote from Sara Morales, and I think it's 30 years old, when he said that the architect's obligation is to posit for each step both the goal and its grounding, to walk on air using this critical framework. And I think it's very true, because it is, at one level, it seems very certain when you think about the evidence of architecture, but the actual act of it is one of profound incertitude and doubt. And
exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the word doubt is a really quality label. I mean, you always have to have doubts, because then you reconsider or recalibrate every time again,
yeah,
to be very sure, because you are doubtful. So you have to reposition it, recalibrating it, to be very sure of what you are doing. And by this kind of cycle of redoing, I think that makes your final quality within the architecture.
Yeah, there's this combination of stubbornness and persistence,
mm-hmm,
that are much more valuable parts of being an architect than natural, I don't even know what natural talent is, but you know, the student who arrives into first year and is superb, you know, talks the right way, wears the right shoes, you know, which is never anyone else's experience. Most people don't have that experience. But actually, the ability to stick with something, despite how silly it might be, is an important part of the subject. For you, how was it like when you arrived into university? You had some idea, you knew what drawings were, design was, you'd seen people making things, your father, etc. Was it, so where did you go to school actually to begin with? Was it
I studied in St. Lucas at that moment,
yeah,
in Ghent.
Yeah.
It's now KU Leuven.
Yeah.
It's integrated in the university. So at that moment, in my opinion, a very interesting place. And I studied 6 months in Dundee.
I know that school well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So and that was also very refreshing, and that's maybe why I'm also now like to be in Lausanne to teach. So to always have interaction with different approaches of architecture. I really found that enriching.
Yeah.
Another way of looking towards architecture. And you don't always have to be agree with it. That's not the point. But it's always interesting to see different ways of looking to architecture. And it was nice play. I was lucky to study there, and also to be abroad for a half year was also enriching.
It's an interesting place, because is that not where Kirsten Gier studied as well? And David?
No, they were
in
a few hundred meters further away from the University of Ghent.
Okay.
I was teaching for 8 years there in the University of Ghent.
So this tiny, Ghent is a small city, but a hotbed of architecture then, obviously, at this time. And what was happening there? At what points did you begin to recognize aspects of the subject that you thought you could? You've talked about difference and plurality, which is really interesting, which I think is absolutely in your work, to the point that when I look at your work, you almost make a point of having the difference manifest in the project in a way that, you know, and we'll come back to that. But at what point does that start making sense to you? Was it in college or was it afterwards?
I think it's even more afterwards. In college, you learn the full process, let's say, of making architecture. I was incredibly happy to have my final critics, Rien Steegstra and Rianne Makink of Max One, were there, and at the final critic, they said, okay, you can start we start a new office. They opened a few months a new office. Before he was a project architect, Rins was project architect 8-9 years for OMA.
Yeah.
Rianne was also was my professor at that moment. I at the final critic they asked, okay, you can start in the office, but you have to start within 2 days in Rotterdam. I said, of course, I will do. And I started, and I took my holiday later, and it was incredibly refreshing. And what was the Kunsthal was 2 years before I finished.
Wow.
I think still one, in my opinion, one of the masterpieces of OMA. A lot of elements came in that project in an incredibly interesting way.
Yeah, no,
together.
We were just looking at it yesterday in the office.
I was lucky then to start there with that attitude in Holland, with this kind of openness, totally different in my opinion than in the Flemish context.
Okay.
With a completely other scope, with an openness, material research, and maybe I think there for me was the first moments of also skipping somehow the idea of conventions and re-questioning things in a further in a further way. And I think that was incredibly refreshing, and I also stimulate my students to go abroad after a study, because then those different approaches, and that was for me. I was there 2 years, and by coincidence, because my apartment I rented in the second from someone who was renting an apartment. It stopped after 2 years, and I said, okay, after 2 years I do something else, because it's my first thing, otherwise probably I would spend there more time, because the office was growing from 2-3 persons when I started, 20-22 2 years later, and doing very 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 nice interesting projects. And then there was an incredibly interesting atmosphere, an atmosphere of energy, an atmosphere of research, even an atmosphere of development, and also opening a door is not a door. A door is a connection between two things.
Yeah.
And I think this kind of questions are for me still very valid when I work on when I do my work and when I make architecture.
It's true, and it's interesting you say 2 years, because there is this period when you leave university, which is that first job. I think when you stay for longer than three, your thinking kind of changes in response to these places, and your ambitions and your aspirations. And I think it's an important thing to say, just because a lot of students listen to the podcast, which is that the decision to stay in a job is a decision.
Exactly.
And equally, the decision to leave is every bit as
similar to that decision to stay. They have the same valency. And it doesn't feel that way, but it is that way. And I do also agree with you, because I think, I mean, I came from a very small and at the time very poor country, and so the idea that you travelled to work was kind of essential. And it is something that you feel is much harder for a student in a metropolis like London, where the gravitational force is so strong,
mm-hmm.
that the idea that you would work in Belgium or in Denmark or in Ireland or in wherever, it doesn't come naturally, actually, because everything is here. You're always going to a less interesting place. To me, I always travel because I was also going, you know, some are more pluralistic, some are more multicultural, some are more exciting. So, but I do think it's true. I think travel is important, and seeing other points of view and just testing them out.
Exactly, because if you read monographs of architects, if you sometimes see how much they are, they were even at that time traveling.
Yeah.
Much more than not necessarily for work, but just to study. You see, that's happening with the most important persons mostly.
It's true.
If you look to their work.
It is. I was having a good chat with Beata Holmbach recently, and I was making the point that you could do a really good book on migrant architects.
Yeah.
So, like, everyone from Bobardi to Mies, right? To Cannes, whatever, right? That actually the number of architects who made incredible work in the country not of their birth, and some of them were migrants economically, some of them were refugees, actually. And I think there's this question about architecture and territory, which is that, yes, of course, reading context is important, but sometimes you can read a context that's not your own somehow more lucidly.
I'm very sure of that, because there is the boogie trap, let's say, when you are in the context, that you answer that context with the elements on the table who are normally the answers towards that context.
Yeah.
And if you are even not aware of that,
yeah.
it gives the opening towards another kind of answer on the same precise way, but from another coming from another direction. And that reopens again that question and reopens other questions. And I really believe it's very interesting to also other disciplines in architecture, material development, for example.
Yeah, and regulatory development. And
there
yeah.
are in some industries developments of years that you, if you are open and I... one of my, I think my first project even, was really dealing with found materials somehow in other industries who were years developed that you can just relocate, let's
yeah.
say,
yeah.
and reuse with limits, because they're, but also with a lot of benefits.
Yeah.
And
so you've now, this is interesting, because one of your first, how did you get to that first project? So how did a practice start
that's
to
a
shape?
Good, that's a nice story. It was a gallery for not for art, but in between art and used things, all this kind of scope. Art pieces, but also furniture, we call it in Flemish toegepaste kunst. How to describe in English? Art from related with the making of things.
Gotcha.
For example, a nice cup.
Yeah.
Craft.
Yeah.
In fact, yeah, that's the
yeah.
word craft. I went to that small gallery in Ghent yet for years. It was a small gallery, and the person who have that gallery said, we bought the building beside us, we will change towards over there. We had the idea of not working with an architect because we were happy with where we are in here, but okay, it's maybe too much directed from, let's say, the architecture. We wanted to take distance from architecture, so we don't gonna work with an architect.
Okay.
Are you interested to see the building? I said, yeah, it's very nice. Yeah, let's have a look to the building. And I did a full walk through the building, and I spoke about certain elements. And at the end, she asked to me, well, what are you in fact doing? I said, I'm an architect.
Yeah.
Ah, you are an architect. Okay, yeah. I went out, and in the evening, she called me, do you want to make the project?
Oh, wow, okay.
I said, of course,
oh,
because
lovely.
You spoke in a very interesting way, in a very other way, towards the building that I normally associate with an architect. And that was my first project. I think it the cost at that moment was €25,000.
Wow. and so then you're up, right? So you're still working for somebody else at the same time, but you're doing this on
exactly.
The side.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is then the holiday and the weekend work.
Yeah.
But that's incredibly nice. We had in with Frank and Ingrid very nice talks because those two people were very open there. And they were, yeah, also without any kind of convention, and I found it only a benefit that they did not want to work with an architect.
Yeah.
Because then you could come up with something else, and there were punctual interventions, and it's a, in that sense a very precise way of working. I sometimes only turn the door.
Yeah, that's right. No, I've seen some of these projects.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. So I
yeah.
will show it this evening in the lecture as well. Because it's for me also sometimes the fact that you can be away as architect. That's, I think that when you succeed that, that's even the most interesting.
No, it's true. It's a very interesting one. Like, it's like, because it's... like actually, when you look at those projects, your sensibility or the sensibility of your practice was kind of there, ready to go. Slightly surreal, like there's a slight surrealism. But then I suppose there's something about that that's actually very everyday, in that the everyday assembly of things is frequently quite surreal.
Exactly.
And an awful lot of design seems to be about evening that out into some kind of synthesis. Whereas you, right from the start, have been kind of liking this. Things put against other things and in conversation with other things and expressed as such and open to that. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. And the surrealism sometimes comes because repositioning very evidently things in another way, in another setting, in another context. And it's not about the differences in terms of being very different than something else, it's by repositioning them in another context that they look not evidently. And but I don't mind about that for me. I wanted to answer, and the answer does not have to have a connotation, and it could be very simple. Or it could be looking very strange, but that looking very strange is again not a goal on its own. It's only a kind of consequence of not only working with let's say the vocabulary of the encyclopedia of architecture.
Yeah.
It's not standing outside of that, it's dealing with all those elements, but there to bring them in a kind of other context in relation with each other. And I think and there to answer maybe incredibly direct a question.
Yeah.
And I did a shop Twiggy in Ghent and taking out one floor, and we took out that floor because we wanted to make a slope because people wanted to be very, it has to be very accessible. By taking out that floor, it was the tallest space was the cellar, and that was in fact fitting 200% the full idea of the whole project to mix levels with each other.
Mm.
So, but then it, you could say it looks very strange because the chimney is hanging on the wall on the first floor, and that space is defragmented. It's a full defragmentation, but without being a complex, without doing special techniques, but by doing the most simple things, just taking out the floor.
How much of that is in those early projects was that you discovering stuff on site? How much of that was designed and known before they went to site? Do you know what I mean? Like, because a lot of them feel very matter of fact. Do you know what I mean? Like that there was a process ongoing through the making. Am I correct in reading that?
Completely, because on one hand you have to be, you have to make your full project completely, but then the completeness ends when the project is finished. And
yeah.
And that means that during, for example, that example of the floor that was meant to be a slope, but I said, okay, I can save a lot of money by not replacing the floor. are you open for it? It's an easy thing, of course, to do that, to convince people with budget, but okay, it was the precise thing to do at that moment. And that happened in the construction site itself. By seeing that, by after the floor was taken out, I said, yeah, but that's exactly what we wanted. We did not have that in mind.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of decisions, you have to stay open even during the construction site for switches, but you still have to prepare everything like there is no switch anymore.
Yeah. Well, you're not, serendipities happen to people who are ready for them. You know, the things that might be luck or the specific insight, they don't happen without you having some kind of formation in advance of that. Do you know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think this is true both of setting up a practice, like the conversation with the woman who ran the gallery. It also happens with careers and life, being curious. But it happens on site all the time, and it happens in client conversations all the time. But if you haven't put in the, not the hard work, but you know, the rigorous work, you don't see the thing where you realize that some of that work was wrong, and it's better when it was wrong, that you can see that it was wrong.
That's the only possibility. You have to did your homework completely, because then you know all the elements who are counting, and then you can shuffle very fast, because you know all the consequences, you know all the important elements, all the triggers, the opportunities and the full picture. And that's the only way when you you can shift or turn something in another kind of direction.
Yeah.
And that's not possible without that preparation.
Yeah, it's a funny one where I think one of the things that was lucky also for us was that our first jobs were very small and almost nothing. I think the budget for our first job was 10,000, but it meant we got to site very fast. Like within a few months of the design starting, you were on site or in the equivalent of a site situation. And I mean, the thing that I was most scared of leaving university was site, was builders and making. Not scared, but they seemed so expert and I seemed to know nothing, you know? And then you very quickly learn that, yeah, you do know nothing, but that doesn't mean that you can't work with these people and ask the intelligent question that reveals more of their intelligences than they might otherwise be asked to do. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. First, about your first point, look to the first project of Geitzo Hendemel.
Yeah.
This small extension.
Yeah.
That they did. I mean, this is an incredible precise on all levels.
Yeah.
It's a masterpiece. And I think the involvement in the making is really key to come to that result.
Yeah.
And that's it. And for me, that means also, and I come to now to your second point, being on the construction site, the moment you design a project and you give it to an executor who is different than you,
yeah,
I think you lose often. In especially maybe in some types of architecture it's different. But in the way I produce the architecture, it's very important that I'm still at in the construction site on all levels, because there we come to the point that if there is a problem in the way of making it, then you have to shift and then you turn things, but it still has to be in the total picture, and it still has to fulfill the totality. And that means that it's not a technical point, and it's still, it could be very strange approach, but you have to be there, because you cannot expect that a craftsman can follow the attitude. He can reach you different approaches, but there is maybe only one who really fulfill the full story.
No, it's true, and I actually think that there aren't actually projects where that isn't useful. We're doing a project at the moment, this one I was telling you about before we started recording, this infrastructure plant, wastewater treatment plant, 27 different design specialisms, ecologists, everything. And I suppose it's been running for 7 years, and so there's 27 design specialisms to design it, there's the same to construct it, and then there's a huge crew of people building it. And I'm the only person that's the same person at the table as it was 7 years ago.
Okay.
And it's not that I'm changing things on site, but I know why decisions were made. And I think that having a steward for a project, like a custodian sometimes, or somebody who just remembers, no, hang on, the actual process engineers pointed this out at that meeting 6 years ago, and okay, I'm not a process engineer, but when you say it, the process engineers go, oh yeah, that's kind of interesting. And so I think there's something about architecture, which is that you don't always have to be designing to be useful. And I think some of our bigger firm models in architecture, they have these things where one team does the pitch for the competition, another team does the planning application, another team does the tender, another team builds it. See, something is lost in that process that is very difficult to quantify, but you absolutely feel it in the work. And to some extent, I would say this, wouldn't I? But just having somebody who knows where the bodies are buried in the process is so useful in
exactly.
These projects. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
I think some approaches in architecture working different.
Yeah.
And some types of projects can work also different. And maybe there is also an opportunity for some types of work to really go deeper in that.
Yeah.
That we can partly, I don't say completely, but partly can distract from that attitude of designing everything one-to-one from scratch.
Yeah.
Because there is, in my opinion, our mental shift that we sometimes have to learn to do. But I know it's a difficult transition.
Yeah.
And it's not working for everything, in my opinion, because then it comes very fast to what you just Andrew described of loss in the final quality somehow.
Yeah.
In that last precisions, in that last calibrations, it starts to be more global, in my opinion. A kind of very good work, but not this kind of shift who makes in all kind of layers everything precise. But on the other hand, a future of architecture, we are one of the last industries where we only develop piece by piece. We redesign every day a new car. But no one is so except a few brands but they are not a handful brands who are making objects one to one. And we are sometimes still in that kind of region.
Yeah.
And I think there is an opportunity.
Mm.
If you look to the work of Sol de Wiet,
yeah,
he explained how you have to make something, and the outcome of the maker gives a kind of interesting, precise, even personal direction to that work. What makes that work also very precise and interesting.
Yeah,
and that's
specific.
An incredibly interesting, in my opinion, future attitude. How can we find that calibration?
No, it's true. I mean, you're talking about the wall drawings in particular,
exactly.
By the way.
Yeah. Where he really described how to do it.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, I'm the artist, now I describe what you can do. And then the involvement of the person itself, giving also a specificness on its work,
yeah,
but without losing any quality of its work.
No, it's true. It's a question to do with the construction industry as well. I have friends who did that, where they made specific tiled bricks, you know, with a beautiful pattern, and the builder said, "Oh, which way do we lay these bricks?" And they said, "No. It's been designed. You can lay them any way, and it will make a really interesting kind of pattern. So you just do what you need to do." And they came to site, and it had been laid every brick identical, so it made this huge grid on the wall. And my friends were, no, you can do it, you can mess it up. And they were like, no, we like it like this.
So
it was quite nice. So it was like it became almost too precise for them. They weren't comfortable to see this precision.
They were not able to even found the freedom in it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I think we're beginning. I think it's a discipline that we've got so far to go with that, because it's almost like we need to have schools where you're building relationships with people who make much more intrinsically as part of your work. Do you know what I mean? That you understand the dignity of the act of making and the concerns of people who make. Do you know what I mean?
But maybe to answer to that idea of that the bricks were laying equally, there it's not so evident.
Yeah.
This kind of approach, because those craftsmen are, you the definition has to be that it cannot lead to something uninteresting.
Yeah.
And but that's enormous difficult.
It is.
That's enormous difficult.
Well, what you're talking about is collaboration of a sort. Like, that's a collaboration over a distance. I mean, and it's worth saying, because like you have had a practice where you've collaborated with different people, and I'm just wondering about that, because like, and now you're back directing a practice on your own and doing. Actually, I can thread you through all of that experience. But I just wanted to talk to you about that, because what was that like, the collaboration with Jan and Inge and that whole period of your career?
Well, for me, it was not a difference than what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
And what I did before. So in that sense, we did 10 years nice projects, in my opinion.
Yeah, great projects.
With a fine openness. But it's also interesting to every several time to recalibrate yourself. Recalibrating means sometimes it's good to before collaborators believe that they know what you think. To go on.
Yeah.
Because they're and you see it happening in so many offices that there starts to be inequality in the outcome of the projects.
Hmm.
What is, in my opinion, mostly, it's difficult to be general, of course, but mostly less interesting after a while. And that becomes, in my opinion, that's a result of that people start to think that they know what you think.
Yeah.
But I think every project has a new investigation, has a new research, has a new test, has a not in in a way that you on your clients test things who can fail. No, as a kind of ongoing research for yourself to be more precise in what means architecture for you in the next project. And I think for that reason it's nice to always somehow restart.
Oh yeah, totally. And I can completely see that. And I think the reason I bring it up also though is because collaboration is such a part of architecture, and I know that listeners to this will be in practices where they might be thinking of moving in a new direction, right? Or the people might be thinking, oh, I might set up a partnership with this person. And I think that it's lovely the way you talk about it, because it is obviously just a very simple human relationship, and architecture isn't damaged by making the call that's right for a relationship and
exactly.
Right for the work. And I think an important thing to say, because we don't talk enough about, you know, these kinds of things. Like, in some ways they shape work as profoundly as anything else. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a specific aspect in that sense is, for me also, we have to get rid of the attitude of the one architect.
Yes.
Who is doing architecture. It's on one hand always a team.
Yeah.
Small or big, that does not matter. And it's even a team with to extend it with the people who make it.
Yeah.
Because they help to direct as well. But we were coming from offices where there's one name.
Yeah.
And of course my office has also know the name, because if it's just about taking the history with you.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And not, but it's called architekten.
Yeah.
That means not architect, but that means more than one architect. Because I really work in my office as a team. The work is guided by the people who are in your office and influenced and helping direct it. Of course, you sometimes.
No, it's a good reading of something, I think, which is that, you know, the room should be different when you're in it, right? Not you personally,
yeah.
But any architect.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
If the room isn't different for your presence, well, you know what? There's probably a better room for you to be in where you'll be heard or valued. And it's definitely been the case in our practice that the people who've come in and out of the practice have changed just, you know, to a huge extent. But then there's this other question as well, which is, this is complex, because I for sure don't agree that you need a dictating the thinking of an office with the brand architect. And I also don't believe that architecture can happen spontaneously through a corporate structure.
Exactly. That's true.
Yes, so there is an authorship, but it's not vested in one person. I think it's a much more complex authorship we're trying to talk about. Because
mm-hmm.
So often people put this into binaries, like, oh, we're a collective, we all make decisions together. Now, we all know that's bullshit. There's a decision-making process in any collective which has authorship structures in it. And an intelligence, and human intelligence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That completely true. I think the balance is just to be found in between. And finally, there has to be one who take the final directions, and if not, it cannot lead to very interesting work.
No.
In my opinion. Because I really don't believe in the mechanisms of deciding with all together, because deciding with all together means cutting off the edges.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's coming to mediocrity.
Yeah.
It leads to the thing who is the less contrary.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just like in teaching. Sometimes you don't speak about the people who are from, let's say, not very bad, but just a step after towards very good or not very good, but a step before. This range is mostly quite clear for if you teach together with a few persons, it's mostly quite clear. But sometimes, strangely, you can have a debate about being very exceptional good.
Yes.
And even very bad.
Yes.
And that's the interesting thing, in my opinion, why you cannot say then, in an average, this kind of exceptional good one will be skipped out of the system.
Yeah.
And that's why it's not possible there has to be indeed someone who finally says, yeah, no, we go for that, and we have to believe in that, and we go for that. We take now that decision.
Yeah. When it's, and actually this also applies to this question about the student you've talked about, which is very true, which is that it's happened a couple of times in my career where you've come into a room.
Me too.
Where, actually as an external examiner is where I saw it, where you'd be in a room and the staff would be having a fight between who this top student was, and there would be a proportion of the staff saying, I'm not sure this student should even pass.
Exactly.
Yeah. And they're always very interesting moments because it really is a place where a school figures out its ethics and how pluralist it can be, or how generous it can be, or where it draws the line, right? And I think there's a question about that, which is to do with, if we're a discipline that recognises the multiplicity of ways that architecture can be done, and I think we are, thank heavens, beginning to become that profession, then we cannot differentiate based on our philosophical positions or the style of the work. We have to be able to engage with empathy with the sincerity of the questions. And that's the only thing. Like, how accurate is the question here? How well is it formed? And it can even be something which is intuitive to the person, not even rhetorically. They might not be able to speak it well, you know? And I think that generosity, for sure, is how we find new knowledge always, which is discovering, hang on, they're saying things here that we just have to talk about because it's really beautiful, or whatever the question is. Do you know what I mean?
Or it's because of the question is maybe answered in a very other kind of way than we regularly see.
Yeah.
But if it's very consequent in the way it's approached, it's for me very interesting. I was trained in the direction of a certain kind of architecture. I'm now training, in my opinion, people not in a certain kind of direction. I hope they are not equal doing things like me.
Yeah.
I just try to learn them being very consequent and very precise in what they are doing.
Yeah.
And that they question things and that they answer those things in their very personal way. Probably in a language who is not totally not mine, but within a language who is consequent and precise.
Yeah.
And really accurate.
Yeah, there's an interesting one there, which is, again, just for the benefit of students, which is that no one expects you to copy the person that's teaching you. Do you know what I mean? No one wants that. Well, sorry, that's not true. There are people who want that.
Exactly.
Okay. And I think a student is very fast at figuring out that situation. I remember I was. And I think staff or people can continually underplay the intelligence of students to read the context that they're in. But it's also worth saying that if someone had said to me, because in our school definitely there was a culture that it felt open, but really there was a way to talk and a way to make work, and that was the cool way to do it. And even if you resented it, I actually didn't mind dressing up in it for a while, because it's also worth saying this to students, dressing up occasionally, if you don't know what else to do, just dress up as Yotelier for a week, actually is a way to unlock projects too. Like, I still do it. I'll put a reference on the desk and go, okay, so today I'm Nino Bobardi and I'm going to try and do this, right?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
But that's another approach, in my opinion. That's, then you don't direct the students towards being Lina Bobardi for his life.
Yeah.
You want to be a student, Lina Bobardi, for 1 month to learn how she's thinking, and to be afterwards open to say, it's totally uninteresting, or it's in my most fascination as it could be. And I think that's interesting because you, in especially in my opinion, in the bachelor's, you have students who are, where the background is very incredibly limited.
Yeah.
The scope of reference frame is small.
Yeah.
And by being one day Lina Bobaidi, the other day Mies van der Rohe, you open the scope for them. And I think that's another approach than saying for the rest of your life you has to be Lina Bobaidi, otherwise you make totally uninteresting architecture. Because I believe that for a 1 on 10, probably that way of working fits very precisely to their personality.
Yeah.
But for a 9 of 10, it's interesting to see, but to come to the to something else.
Yeah.
And we were in the past more taught in terms of, you know, be sure Lina Bobaidi is the only way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you still see that. I mean, I still think we have Puritan thinking in schools. And I don't think that's ever going to go away. Do you know what I mean?
Of course. And it's easy as well for some students, probably.
It is. And it's easy for the tutor because they can, to return to where we were, the doubtful practice is a harder practice to teach. Because it's more tiring, more exhausting to continually have to read from somebody else's position. But it does seem to be a transformative kind of teaching. It does seem to be a kind of teaching that can get students more agency, or they can find more agency that way. We always end these interviews with a question, which is, if you had to give some advice to a student thinking of studying architecture, what would it be, like a single piece of advice?
I would say be open and stay away from conventions and recalibrate those kind of conventions by mostly explain to a student that he don't has to design a sleeping room, but that he has to think about a way of sleeping.
Yeah.
That you don't have to design a kitchen, but that you have to think about a way of cooking. And translate it into architecture. If you have this kind of openness, then you can answer with not the vocabulary of architecture, but you can answer with a full encyclopedia.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think that's the most interesting, and because that leads to question things, and questioning things means every generation has other questions. We are up for new questions about sustainability, for example.
Mm.
And with an open attitude, you can answer not in the way it's evidently has to be asked, but you do by skipping those conventions, you do yet research in terms of coming to a much more interesting way of answering that question.
Yeah, I think it's true. Like it's... conventions weight thought. Conventions give an up and a down. You know, they give you a value system that you can work against. But it's a lot of them are entirely constructed. And if you want to rely on them, you have to test that at some point.
Exactly.
And I think this is true. And I think that one of the things that I think sustainability and decolonial thinking, I think, like there's something amazing happening in architecture right now, which is I think the languages of architecture are reconnecting with cause and consequence and meaning, like in a way that's very that's very profound, actually. Do you know what I mean? Which I think and exciting, actually. I find it kind of exciting because, like, say some of the techniques that are in your practice to do with collage and bricolage and assembly, well, actually, they were in your practice before for other reasons, but they're very timely concerns to have now, and suddenly that language becomes even more alert or exciting.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. And, yeah, because by that element of re-questioning is because I see too evidently it's it's maybe for young architects too triggering to follow the generation before, because they know that the recipe works.
Yeah.
And I think you have to be one step before, and that means not walking
in
the same way.
Yeah.
But making interesting mistakes.
Yeah. Yeah, because the work that generation that's teaching you comes from those interesting mistakes.
Exactly, they
time.
Were also experimenting. If you sometimes see how I found quite recently something I never saw, one of the first incredibly small Kaban, I thought it was from Jean Nouvel.
Yeah.
Almost a stone, limited to sleep, and what an experiment. I mean, so that's so fascinating. So stay away from the things you know, because they yet exist. Reproduction of what is existing is behind.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's a new thing, it stays always, you are always too late. And it's not about being the most fancy one, not at all. It's being the most precise one. Be consequent with the things you do and recalibrate them. What you believe, what has to be the outcome of things.
Yeah, that's a lovely way to wrap up. Yo, thank you so much for your time. I'm looking forward to your talk.
Thank you so much for the interview.
Thanks for listening. And thanks to all of you who got in contact since we restarted this series. It's been really lovely to hear from you all. Sometimes you don't think that these conversations are being heard or that they matter in a way. And so it's really lovely to hear from those of you who connected. If you do like what we're doing, do send a review or send me a note. It's all greatly appreciated. And I'll catch you next time when we're joined by Anna Minton. And very much looking forward to that. Take care. Bye.